time.
Yes, you have 10 minutes.
Should I? I do? Really? Okay. So, yeah, that's good. Okay. Well, I'll try to keep it to 10 minutes, I guess. I thought we ended at 10, and it's a shame we don't have time for questions, because I have a lot of questions for the folks here. But we'll see. You guys mind staying an extra 5 minutes, or should I could buzz through this in 5 minutes if people really want to end at 10. Yeah, the good thing about going last is that people have said stuff that you were going to say, so your presentation can be shorter, and the bad thing is it has to be shorter because...
But do you have the slide?
The slide that will sum it all up and oh, I don't have the pyramid slide, actually, so I can't buzz through that. So anyway, I'm with an organization called Health Alliance International and also on faculty at University of Washington. Really, though, here I'm representing a group of organizations that have come together to write and sign on to this NGO Code of Conduct, which is sort of a corollary, if you will, to the Paris Declaration. I'm going to just take a couple of minutes, no disclosures, to give a little context for aid and aid effectiveness, I think a little different perspective than what we've heard, although I really appreciate the presentations of Michael Hammer and Dr. Gribble. I think they build on what I was what we're going to say about the need for this code of conduct. But, you know, there's one perspective in which aid is going up and aid for health is going up, and there's certainly different ways you can look at numbers to, you know, manipulate these things. But when you look at the way that GNP has gone up in, and this is from a graph from the WHO report of the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, in the developed world and rich countries, aid has really not kept pace with that at all. And the 0.7 commitment that the UN asks of nations to make, you know, very few nations have actually made that. And aid has, when you look at it this way, has really stayed about flat. Another way to look at it from the Center for Global Development is taking out Iraq, for example, taking out and looking at excluding debt relief. You also see that over the last few years, anyway, there hasn't been a huge increase in net development assistance. And again, another way to look at it, from OECD data by an organization called Reality of Aid, a consortium called Reality of Aid, in just sub-Saharan Africa, aid minus debt relief, again, has remained pretty flat. So if it's not going, if we're not spending it on aid, what are we spending it on? And again, I think we like focus so much on our little crumbs, our little piece of the pie. I do think it's important to inject this perspective on this. And this is from 2003. It's not a surprise, you know, we all know this, but I think we need to constantly keep it in mind. So often we're sort of fighting over the crumbs. We need to spend more time bringing attention to these issues rather than, you know, fighting between ourselves. And this is, again, just another way of looking at it based on the monthly spending for military operations, the Iraq war versus education, health, population, water supply and sanitation. You can't even see the line. So. And where is the money not going? So the money is going. Here's where the money is going. Where is the money not going? Well, We talk about aid as if it all goes, you know, it's an aid effectiveness, and the Paris Declaration really deals with aid that goes into public investment more so, as Dr. Gribble pointed out, than aid that goes directly to NGOs. And public investment in developing countries has actually declined quite dramatically since the peak in 1982, and this is all investment into public systems. And why is public investment inclined? Again, I think it's important to be explicit about this because, you know, there's a lot of talk about strengthening health systems and the fact that health systems are so degraded, I think, but very little historical context or recognition of why we are here in the first place. And I think, you know, structural adjustment programs and IMF-imposed fiscal and monetary policies have certainly contributed to a definancing, if you will, of public systems. Here we're talking about health systems, but all public systems, education, other kinds of public infrastructure. A lot of controversies about aid to the public sector, questions about accountability, questions about corruption have made giving aid to governments less fashionable. And then theories about the predatory state, that the private sector really is a much more efficient way to deliver a lot of these services. And in fact, that public systems might disencourage or crowd out the private sector. George Bush famously used this argument in arguing against an expansion of S-CHIP. In this country, saying that, oh, if we do that, then private insurance companies will be less likely to come in. And here, one of the principal proponents of this philosophy. So what really happened? Well, private sector didn't compensate for the drop in public investment. IMF research, the report on the Commission of Africa, are some recent recognitions of that. And this graph, another graph from the WHO report on the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, shows that actually looking at health-adjusted life expectancy, and the little dots are I think 180 countries here, a percent of private expenditures as your total health expenditures is actually correlated with a decrease in health-adjusted life expectancy here. And another quote, about 100 million people pushed into poverty through catastrophic health costs that result from payments for access to services. Now, you know, I know that this is supposed to be about aid effectiveness, but again, I think we really have to focus and be explicit, because there's a lot of people at this conference and in other conferences as well talking about this in broad terms, talking about, gee, we have these degraded health systems, and what are we going to do? And there's a lot of focus on investing more in the private sector, investing more in NGOs, and not so much focus really explicitly in investing more in the public sector. So I think it's important to look at that context. I'm going to just slide through these because you guys all know we don't have enough health workers. So in this sort of vacuum of disinvestment in public systems and reliance on private systems that didn't really pan out, in fact, in many cases hurt people, what happened? Donors turned to NGOs because they couldn't really finance the public sector because of a lot of these larger political forces. And NGOs really expanded dramatically over the past 10 to 20 years. And here are some examples of that. USAID in 1970 was supporting about 18 NGOs, and by 2000, 195, I'm sure, Carol, it's much more than that now. And just an example of PEPFAR, about 16% of the total PEPFAR aid goes to governments directly, and about 84% goes to NGOs and other private institutions. And this is from a Tanzania. You know, the perception in Africa certainly is that Wanjiku is a name for like the common man in Tanzania and Kenya, and the perception in Africa of where is aid going. Not much of it is getting down to communities. And this is substantiated by, you know, some research that's been done by several different organizations. ActionAid report called Real Aid shows that about 50% here is actual real aid, and a lot of the rest of it gets sent back in debt relief, technical assistance, not coordinated well. And another assessment from the reality of aid, the percent that goes to technical assistance. And I'm not saying that technical assistance isn't appropriate or necessary in a lot of situations, but 40% of aid going to technical assistance by this assessment. You know, we can argue over that whether that's appropriate or not, but certainly it's not going to other things if it's going to technical assistance. And I'm just going to breeze through these. Some examples of how complicated. So in this kind of environment, a number of NGOs came together because we recognized from where our work in the field, and I worked in Mozambique, for a couple of years, that there were groups that were figuring out ways to really strengthen health systems to sort of channel their resources more directly into the public health systems. And there are groups that were working at odds with public health systems. And I go through some examples here of how that is perceived from if you're sitting at the Ministry of Health and how difficult that is when you're trying to have this huge management burden, and some of the ways specifically that NGOs can negatively affect public health systems. But the group of us came together and started trying to enumerate these and be very explicit about practices, both good and bad, practices that we felt should be encouraged, practices that we felt needed to be called out. And, you know, from the Ministry of Health's perspective, this is bilateral donor support to Tanzania and a number of different projects and donors and how they allocate their funds and, you know, keeping track of all this. This is not just health, but, you know, you could get a similarly complicated graph if you looked at health, is a really difficult management burden. This is just a graphic example, the Ministry of Health in the middle of all the different bilateral, multilateral, international agencies that have to be coordinated. And this is a graphic, again, of the commodity logistics system in Kenya and who's controlling what based on what commodity. Just for health, again, and again, just to show you that, you know, sometimes help is a good thing, sometimes, you know, internal brain drain is another thing that the Code of Conduct addresses, the inequities. And again, I just want to point out, you know, I heard this argument the other day. I was in a focus group around this leadership core that is being developed to send managers into developing countries to provide technical assistance. And it's going, and what they're focusing on is providing managers from corporations in the US to international NGOs, kind of not even talking about the public sector management issues. And we asked them, why are you doing that? Why aren't you, you know, providing these managers directly to the health systems? And they said, oh, well, we want something that will happen fast, that will give us fast results. And I hear this all the time. You know, the private sector, fast results, we don't have to deal with the bureaucracies of government, it's so much nicer. And that's true. You can see by this graph, a private NGO not connected to the ministries of health, this is a scale-up of HIV treatment in Mozambique, in central Mozambique, and they got a lot of patients on very quickly and showed really good results in the first year or so of the program. And then the Ministry of Health was much more slow in scaling up. But the Ministry of Health clinics, obviously, one NGO in one place cannot scale up HIV for a whole country. And once the Ministry of Health really started scaling up in all of its clinics, you can reach a large population, which the NGO levels off and can't do. So this is the problem that we were faced with. Certainly there's a good role for NGOs. Certainly we have something to contribute, and the challenges is doing that without taking over. Here's the partners that have helped develop the Code of Conduct. We have over 35 signatories right now in addition to these. And I'm way out of time, but there were copies. I'm looking at the table now. It doesn't look like there's many copies. But I'll give you the website. It's ngocodeofconduct.org. It addresses hiring practices, employee compensation, and the sort of internal brain drain issues, joint planning, training, trying to discourage short courses and more investment in pre-service training, joint planning, as I said. Talking about how NGOs can link or sometimes isolate communities from public sector services, and really this principle really dealt with also how NGOs have to play a role sometimes, a protective role, an advocacy role for oppressed communities, and sometimes that's an important thing to acknowledge. And the importance that we have as NGOs of embracing our role for advocacy, because a lot of these issues, really, we are the ones, the implementers in the field, that are able to see these issues, and it's a very important responsibility, I think, for those of us who work in the field to bring those stories back to the policymakers, because there's so often this huge disconnect. Okay, and now Ollie's not going. That's it. Thank you. And thanks for your patience. I'm sorry for overrunning.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all our presenters, particularly Elizabeth, who came all the way from France, and Michael, who came from the UK, explicitly for this panel. I know we have to leave, but maybe we can stay behind and talk while the others get ready. Thank you very much. And you can contact me if you want copies of the presentations or if you want to get in touch with the presenters.